Morning. I'd like to start off the meditation this morning with a quote from a textbook that was required reading for me in the course that I took in Prophets at Emmanuel Bible College in Kitchener, Ontario, back in the late 70s, early 80s. Emmanuel is a stalwart conservative evangelical college of the Evangelical Missionary Church of Canada. The church that I was licensed with when we came to Quebec in 1981. The author of the quote is a guy by the name of Stephen Winward, and it's part of his chapter on the prophet Micah, and the passage that was read from Micah is where I'm going to give my focus this morning. Winward paints Micah as a champion of the oppressed, and there's no real surprise there. Most of the prophets are champions of the oppressed. And Winward particularly likes the passage that was read this morning from chapter 6 of Micah. And here's the quote. With his predecessor Amos and his older contemporary Isaiah, he stands at the head of that great procession of men who through the ages have championed the cause of the oppressed. And I'll bracket here, and in fairness to Winward and his use of the masculine gender here, he does, in fact, mention a woman in the list of champions that I'm about to read. So he goes on. In this company of the concerned are John the Baptist and James, the Lord's brother, Francis of Assisi and Vincent de Paul, Elizabeth Fry and Anthony Shaftesbury, Charles Kingsley and Thomas Barnardo, and many others. Not all the others are saints. For we may see the spirit of Micah at work in more turbulent figures, for example, in John Ball, who took a prominent part in the Peasants' Revolt of 1381, and in Karl Marx, the fountainhead of a more recent and greater revolution. Winward then inserts a quote from Martin Luther King, and King says, "With all of its false assumptions and evil methods, communism arose as a protest against the injustices and indignities inflicted upon the underprivileged. The Communist Manifesto was written by men aflame with a passion for social justice." Winward then picks up the text again and he says, "They differ greatly, yet Micah and Marx have something in common. The influence of the prophet has not been confined to his contemporaries, but like leaven, it has been at work in society down the ages." I don't know if Winward is still used at Emmanuel as a text for reading the prophets. My guess would be that it's not, but I could be wrong. Mind you, I do have a sort of a vague recollection of a warning from our prof at the beginning of this course on the prophets that we needed to read Winward with a selective eye and be careful. And I suspect that this section of glowing praise for well, somewhat glowing praise of Karl Marx probably fits under the category of tread carefully with this guy. Anyway, Winward then immediately follows up that part, follows up on the passage with a section entitled Basic Religion, and he says, "The book of Micah contains one of the best summaries of true religion to be found in the Bible. It is preceded by a scene in a court of law. The culprit in the witness box is Israel, the prosecutor is God. All my people, what have I done to you? In view of all his saving deeds, some of which are mentioned, why has Israel behaved so badly? Does the Lord deserve such ingratitude and disobedience? Then comes the great oracle, the Mount Everest of the Old Testament, for which alone the book of Micah deserves immortality." And Winward then references the passage from chapter 6, "Do justice, love kindness, and walk humbly with God." The Mount Everest of the Old Testament. What a beautiful image. And I'm tempted at the end of the meditation right there. The Mount Everest of the Old Testament. Do justice, love kindness, and walk humbly with God. Do justice. Love kindness. Walk humbly with God. How do you improve on that? Sure, we might not fully agree on what constitutes justice in a given situation. The children's story already raised that question, what's the fair and right thing to do? What's wrong? Why is it wrong? We might not always agree on what constitutes the best way forward. In preparing this meditation this week, I came across an article written by a pastor in Southern California making an argument for why, to some extent, it's a Christian imperative to support Donald Trump. And I shook my head reading the article. But part of his argument was, he quite explicitly says, I don't care about the man's moral code or whether he has one or doesn't have one. I don't care about how he acts individually. What I care about is what he promotes as what's best for the nation. And then he lists things that for him constituted the best for the nation. So godly policies, protecting the borders, putting good judges into the Supreme Court who will protect certain values. We might not fully agree on what constitutes justice. But I don't think that that's quite the point in Micah's call here. If we are truly, honestly seeking justice, I think we're on the right track. And we will push forward in an effort to be just in our own dealings with others. Love, kindness, or mercy. In other words, recognize that a dose of compassion can go a long way to help create a society where justice is the norm. Not a rigid, heartless, punishment-oriented justice, so much as a justice tempered with love and truly just measures. Walk humbly with God. That one might be a little bit more difficult to flesh out as to what Micah anticipates from that. What does it mean to walk humbly with God? I looked at a number of translations of Micah to see if I could maybe find a hint or get a bit of a handle on some nuance here, but unfortunately, pretty much all of the English translations basically say the same thing and use more or less the same words. Walk humbly, walk in humility. I did come across a couple of translations that tweaked it just a little bit more, that rendered the verse something along the lines of walk thoughtfully with God or walk carefully with God. And I think they might be helpful additions to the idea of a humble walk with God, and they maybe inject a bit of a note of quiet reflection as to what that means. But I'm not sure I want to simply replace the image of humility with the image of being careful or being thoughtful. I think there's something in the notion of humility in God's presence that's essential to our walk of faith. And I don't think it's related to the absolute difference between an omniscient, omnipotent God and a limited human being. I think there's a subtle flavor of what humility is that's necessary in how we walk. It brings to my mind, anyway, one of Bruce Cockburn's songs from 40 years ago or whatever, Can I Go With You? And I think pretty much the opening line of that is when you, I have to sing it to. Something along, when you rise out of the shining stars. Oh, I can't. I'm losing it then. Anyway, the idea is that when you return to call those who love you, can I go with you? Not an arrogant, my God is a great God, and when you come back, I will rise in the sky to meet you. No, when you come back, when you come out of the shining sky, accompanied by clouds or hosts of angels, can I be among the people that you take? I think there's something in the notion of humility in God's presence that's essential to our walk of faith. I don't think it's related to the absolute omnipotence of God. I think it has more to do with an attitude of faith that accepts that this life we have is a gift from God, as is the life that has been given to everyone around us, and that this gift comes with a certain responsibility to treat it with care, not a license to act however we want. A recognition that the call to walk humbly with God is intrinsically tied to the first two parts of that oracle, do justice and love kindness. It's perhaps also a subtle reminder that doing justice and loving kindness will challenge us, and that we'll probably most often fall a bit short of how we know we should be living out those two instructions about doing justice and loving kindness. In other words, do justice and love kindness, but don't become complacent or smug in your walk with God. And when I first picked up on this image of Micah's call being the Mount Everest of the Old Testament, my first thought and my first interpretation of that was an image of Mount Everest being the summit of faithfulness, the apex of discipleship, the high point of religious fidelity, that shining beacon showing us the way forward. But then my dark Scottish humor kicked in, and I started ruminating on the fact that there are a lot of dead bodies on Mount Everest. A lot of evidence that reaching the summit's not a walk in the park. Not something you undertake without a lot of preparation, a lot of equipment, and a collection of people who will help you get there safely, if not easily. It's not a climb for the faint of heart. It's of necessity a team effort, and not an individual sport. It's a bit of a reminder, to me at least, that although Micah's call can and should be taken as a call to individual integrity and humility, it's also a call to the nation of Israel as a whole, in Micah's case. It's not just a personal admonition for good living. It's a reminder to the entire nation that God expects them as a society to adhere to this model on a macro scale. It's a call to adopt policies and practices that encourage justice. A call to enact legislation that's tempered with mercy. And a call to all of this, because this is what we were created for. To act justly, to love kindness, and to walk humbly with God. We weren't created so that we'd have space to suck whatever we could out of life, regardless of how that affects those around us. We were created, I think, to embrace life together, to co-create with God a society built on a concern for right relationships and justice. And a number of commentaries will also, and in fact most of them will point out, that this declaration from Micah directly ties our relationship with each other to our relationship to God. Windward at some point quotes another older writer who puts it this way. He says, "The one thing that matters is how men stand with God. And the one test of that is how they stand with other men." And I think there's an echo there of the requirement in Leviticus and Deuteronomy to love God with everything you have and to love your neighbor as much as you love yourself. Or the Ten Commandments that start off by spelling out how we are to behave towards God, the first three or four commandments, depending on how you split the commandments, but then give most of their time to spelling out how we're to behave to each other. Or James' observation that religion that's pure and undefiled before God is to visit orphans and widows in their affliction and to keep yourself unstained from the world. I'm convinced that the true test of our faith isn't what we say we believe, but rather how we demonstrate what we truly believe by how we live our lives. And how we live out our relationship to each other, I think, is a good measure of how we live out our relationship with God. Thank you.